The president has ordered thousands more troops into Afghanistan.
This is your mission, should you choose to accept it.
They're going with an exit strategy in hand and a clear mission: train the Afghans.
We have to have a partner that can identify, recruit, retain a security force and a police force that are able to take an improved security environment and eventually hold that area.
Pardon the cliche, but is it mission impossible? For the soldiers going overseas to fight, do they believe Afghanistan can have a strong, independent army in 5 years? It's their mission in Obama's war.
This tape will self-destruct in 5 seconds.
Expect the impossible, indeed, on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, December 1st, the last month of the 2009. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry.
Good morning, Celeste. Also on the program, searching for jobs amidst a river of layoffs. There might be opportunities in those pink slips. The complex financial camouflage of paying for health care reform. Will anyone actually be paying more? We'll find out. And marriage troubles in Catholic Argentina. Also, the difficulties of trying to get out of a bad business, toxic assets, and the Federal Reserve.
But first, National Guard Specialist Marco Reiniger joins us. He served in Afghanistan in 2008, is on active duty, and is a spokesperson for IAVA. That's the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. Good morning, Marco.
Good morning, Celeste.
You heard the opening question of whether or not this is a mission impossible for our troops over there. What do you think? Is this too high, is too difficult of a problem to train the Afghanistans to stand on their own within 5 years?
Well, actually, the ANA, the Afghan National Army, during my time there, has made incredible progress. And while I was there, unlike the Afghan police, it was probably one of the better, or if not the best, organization in Afghanistan, and people actually had real trust in them. So I think it's absolutely not impossible. I think we need to have realistic goals, and I think we need to have a clear framework of how to achieve them. But, you know, whatever the president gives us to do, I'm pretty sure the U.S. military, with their civilian support, are going to get it through.
One way or the other, though, we're going to have more veterans coming back from Afghanistan. Is the country prepared to take care of them once they come home wounded?
We're making progress, definitely. There's key legislation that has passed over the last couple of years. The Omnibus Health Services Act was just passed, which not only increases health care and health care benefits for veterans, but it also takes care of caregivers of severely wounded veterans, family members that take care of veterans that can't take care of themselves anymore. So I think we're definitely going in the right direction.
Well, we're going to talk to you more about that in just a moment. National Guard Specialist Michael Reiniger. But first, everything else that you need to know this morning.
Breaking news this morning. A sheriff spokesman in Seattle says Seattle police shot Maurice Clemens. He's a suspect in a killing of four police officers. He was shot to death in a working-class South Seattle neighborhood this morning after police tracked him down using possible hiding spots supplied by local investigators following a intense manhunt over the last few days. As you just heard, President Obama is unveiling his Afghan strategy tonight, part of an expected 30 to 35,000 troop buildup. The White House explains that the first new Marines, will be in the Kandahar region by Christmas.
Iran says it will deal firmly with five British sailors who were seized in Iranian waters last week. The crew was taken to Tehran and are still being held. The British Foreign Secretary says there was no evil intent on the part of the sailors. After finishing the best month since the summer, the Dow is going to open today at 10,344. The S&P is 5 points under 1,100, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,144. And we're asking you tonight, the president will unveil his strategy. What are you listening for?
This is Craig. Tonight, I'd like to hear Obama speak honestly about Pakistan as well as Afghanistan. I feel like we are simply doing crowd control in Afghanistan, where, from what I've read, most of the Taliban leaders, including bin Laden and others, are all in Pakistan.
Tell us your view at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
The president will reiterate the importance of why we're there, but also, by all means, very early on, acknowledge the tremendous cost and sacrifice to our men and women in uniform.
That is White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs talking about the possibly 30,000 more troops that are going to be deployed to Afghanistan to pursue a mission there of capturing areas and then turning them over to an Afghan army that they hope to strengthen and train in the years ahead. We're joined now by three people who are watching this closely. We're rejoined by National Guard Specialist Marco Reininger, who served in Afghanistan in 2008. He's now on active duty. Jack Jacobs also joins us from West Point. He's a retired Army colonel and professor of politics there at the school. And Genevieve Chase is founder of American Women's Veterans, sergeant in the U.S. Army in 2006 in Afghanistan. Good morning to all three of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Sheila.
Genevieve, let's start with you. Are we giving our troops perhaps a ridiculously difficult goal in order to, you know, we're sending more troops over, but we're saying to them, you have to get this Afghanistan army ready to protect its own borders and to protect its own country within 5 years. Is that impossible?
That's a hard question. It's not just a matter of getting the military ready in Afghanistan. It's getting the people motivated and confident and feeling stable enough to want to protect their country. There are a number of security issues, and they feel, I think, for the most part, they feel that if we're not there to continue to support them, that they will be overwhelmed by the Taliban again and that they won't be able to sustain any type of security, especially within 5 years. So it's not just a matter of training. It's also a matter of bolstering their systems and as well as the training.
Jack Jacobs, what do you think? Do the Afghan people have the will to defend themselves?
Well, they have demonstrated that in the past. I think it's a little-known fact that when the Taliban was originally driven out of Afghanistan with our assistance, we had about 600 agents on the ground. And then we ignored the place for the next the better part of a decade. It's not surprising the bad guys came back. Now it's much more difficult to get rid of them. But the Afghan people have demonstrated that they're willing to sacrifice to get the bad guys out. So there's no reason to suspect they're not ready now.
Marco Reininger, you've been on the show before, and you've told us that what the soldiers really want is just a clear, defined strategy. Is that what you're hoping to hear from the president tonight?
I do, and I'm actually pretty confident that that's what we're going to hear. A clear set of objectives and a clear framework that involves both our military and civilian efforts just makes it much more motivating and easy to be in an environment like that, because it gives you a goal.
What about the timeline? Genevieve, let me ask you about the exit strategy. Does having a timeline, maybe that makes it easier on troops to know that, as the White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs says, this is not an open-ended commitment, that the troops will be going in there, doing a job, and then coming home.
I think a timeline, in terms of just being a soldier myself, I believe that timelines that's for the American public. That's not really for us. We know that we're there every moment that we're told to be there for as long as we're told to be there. Will it help troops to say that there's a timeline and to identify one? It'll be a great topic of conversation, but I really think that's about it.
Well, and the conversation will take place among the cadets that President Obama speaks to tonight. Jack Jacobs, depending on where you are in the audience, if you're picking a military career as an officer in special ops, or maybe you're in the rear, sort of infrastructure and logistical realm of the Army and the officer corps, who's most likely to be directly referred to in this speech tonight, do you think?
Oh, well, I think it's going to be the people at the edge of the spear, the special operations and special forces, the four combat brigades, I suspect he's going to send over there, and the mobile training teams, which will be essential to bringing up to speed the local militias who are the closest to making sure that the Taliban and al-Qaeda do not take a foothold there again. So I think he's going to direct his attention to them mostly.
Talk a little about that spear, though. You've got the spear in doing counterinsurgency work against the Taliban, but then you also have troops that are going to have to defend territory while the training takes place, right?
Yeah, that's where I think the four combat brigades come in. What we need to do is the same thing that we recognized we had to do when we finally had the surge in Iraq, and that is to go into areas and stay there. We didn't do that before, and we realized that counterinsurgency will not be successful unless you stay in areas and make them secure. The guys who are running the operation now, Generals Petraeus and McChrystal, understand that completely, that the conventional troops we're going to have there for security are going to have to stay there long enough for the local militias to become adept at rejecting the Taliban.
Marco Reiniger, National Guard Specialist, you're on active duty now. I wanted to read you an email we got from a listener. This is from Tom in Bloomfield, New Jersey. And he says, if Obama adds 40,000 troops to Afghanistan, it will be a disaster. If he begins an immediate 100% pullout, it will be a disaster as well. It sounds like Tom doesn't think we can win in Afghanistan, and no matter what we do, it's going to be a disaster, he says. What can you say to Tom?
Well, he's identified the issue and the difficult situation that we are facing in Afghanistan, and obviously, you know, they're very smart heads trying to analyze the situation. But I think the administration has demonstrated, you know, a very intense commitment to this issue. It's something that's very high up on their agenda, and we've invested large amounts of treasure and blood so far. So I think, like I said, once we set a realistic set of goals, objectives that can actually be achieved, and, you know, I wouldn't necessarily go with timelines and things of that nature. That makes it much more complicated, and it lets the enemy, gives the enemy an opportunity to hold you out. But I think once we have a clear strategy and clear objectives, it's not impossible, and we can definitely achieve what we came there for. The country's not going to look like Switzerland, but, you know, maybe there's something realistic that we can achieve, or there will be, and I think we'll get there.
Well, it sounds to me like the takeaway is that there is a mission that is possible, and it's a question of how these 30,000 troops are deployed and used once they get to Afghanistan. That is National Guard Specialist Marco Reiniger, served in Afghanistan in 2008, now on active duty. We also heard from Jack Jacobs, retired Army colonel and professor of politics at West Point. And Genevieve Chase joined us. She's the founder of American Women's Veterans. She was a sergeant in the U.S. Army in 2006 and served in Afghanistan. Thanks to all three of you.
And I love Marco. You know, Switzerland maybe is not a model. They're banning minarets in Switzerland, so Afghan should just stay Afghanistan for now.
That's an interesting connection there, John. It is 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check on the headlines now.
A sheriff spokesman in Seattle says police have fatally shot the suspect in the slayings of four police officers over the weekend. Authorities had been searching for Maurice Clemens since the Sunday morning shootings near Tacoma. Alleged state dinner party crashers Tarek Salahi was on NBC's Today Show this morning. He says he and his wife did nothing wrong.
This has been the most devastating thing that's ever happened to us. We're greatly saddened by all the circumstances that have been involved in portraying my wife and I as party crashers. And I can tell you we did not party crash the White House.
Salahi says he and his wife are cooperating with the Secret Service and that, quote, the truth will soon come out.
It is World AIDS Day today. In the U.S., Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius says there is still much work to do and the day is a time to recognize accomplishments and set new goals. In South Africa, the President Jacob Zuma is expected to take a public AIDS test today. If it goes ahead, it would mark a significant shift from the previous stance of the South African leadership. South Africa has the highest number of AIDS-related deaths in the world. In international news, the U.N. has criticized the Swiss ban on minarets that John referred to earlier. The UN human rights chief says the ban is discriminatory and puts Switzerland on a collision course with international law. Sunday's referendum was backed by nationalist parties and approved by more than half of the Swiss population.
Those are some of the stories we're following this morning. Coming up, the feds are getting out of the mortgage business, but at what cost to homeowners and taxpayers? What does it mean for the whole housing industry? It's a huge story. Louise Story has it. We'll talk in a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
Here at the News Takeout Counter this morning, we've got Louise Story, Wall Street and finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times, and Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, sports contributor. We've also got some of your voices coming up in just a moment. Let's begin with you, Louise. So the poor Federal Reserve, right, they're so huge, they can print dollars, they have so many of them, and when they try to do something quietly, it doesn't work out that way. What's going on?
They're especially huge now that they've been really holding up the housing market. Just this year, they've bought more than $1 trillion, $1 trillion of mortgage-backed securities.
So the so-called, and these are just a class of the so-called toxic assets that came out of the bank, or maybe not toxic, but questionable assets, the Fed has been buying them.
Well, so these are actually new mortgages that have been being made for the large part. How this works is basically you get a mortgage.
Right.
It's backed by Fannie. It gets bundled into a bond. Usually those bonds were sold to private investors, but there's no private appetite, so the Fed has been buying it. It's making the housing market go.
The subprime crisis got rid of that whole security market, so the Fed has been serving as the substitute.
That's right.
Now they're trying to back out of this icky business.
The question is there going to be a private market that will step in? And the other thing that they're trying to do is just shrink this massive portfolio that they've built up. Their balance sheet is now more than $2 trillion. It's never been this big. And so they're afraid, though, if they sell off these bonds, that it's going to cause really a downward push in the market, maybe panic. So what they're going to do is they're going to lend them out. And they're hoping that that'll be a way they can ease out of this.
But how do you lend out a loan?
Well, actually, there's a market. It's a very complex thing called the repo market. They do this all the time. But it's unprecedented to have to have the government draw out of something like this. And it kind of reminds me of, you know, you've got this balloon. It's very tight with air. They're trying to put air in one side, take it out of the other, all the while not popping the balloon. It's very tricky.
And it's unclear whether they can actually pull this off.
It's unclear. We're facing more foreclosures coming up. And if they don't get out nicely and quietly and without causing panic, we could have another problem.
A huge story that affects every homeowner.
Every homeowner.
Mortgage who wants to get a mortgage as well. Thank you, Louise. Louise Story, Wall Street and Finance reporter for the New York Times.
Okay, let's talk about sports with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. So we have two undefeated teams relatively late in the season.
Yes.
Tell me about the game last night. The New England Patriots, everyone thought this would finally be a real challenge for the Drew Brees and the Saints. Did not turn out that way.
Well, it started off pretty good, but the Saints took over very quickly. They won 38-17 last night.
And now like a Super Bowl game.
That improves their record to 11-0, which is quite possibly one of the best records the Saints have ever had as a franchise. But a couple of things surprised me last night. Number one, that Drew Brees threw to five touchdowns to five different players. And two of those players, Marquise Colson and Devery Henderson, both had over 100 yards receiving. That's a really amazing game. Another thing is, you ever hear of a guy named Brian Hoyer?
No.
Brian Hoyer? Anyone? No.
Sure.
Because
I've heard of him.
Because he was the guy that came in for the Patriots at the end of the game when the Patriots conceded defeat and took Tom Brady out. That's a big surprise. When was the last time you saw Bill Belichick essentially concede defeat to another team? That's pretty spectacular.
How did the cutaways to Belichick's face look in the game last night? I had to go to bed.
I think it looked pretty much what he looks like all the time.
For
listeners, Bill Belichick is the coach for the New England Patriots, and he always wears a sweater with a hoodie that's kind of like rough and tough looking, like if he had big muscles, but he just never smiles. He's always got a scowl on his face, and even when he wins and when he loses. So,
he looks like the bouncer to the world. He could just eject you out into space. That's the nasty look on his face.
Well, he did eject Tom Brady eventually.
He took him out, but I think also Sean Payton, who's the coach of the New England Saints, exactly. He, in a sense, out-coached Bill Belichick. And I think what we're seeing is a passing of a guard right now, what's happening in the NFL, where a different Tom Brady, which is the new Drew Brees, is taking over as the mantle of the sharpshooter, the gunslinger, the best quarterback in the league.
He's also a beloved player in addition to being a star, kind of a superstar.
Yeah.
Players love to play with him.
Yeah.
They do.
Well, quickly, we have a little bit of time left, but let's real quickly mention Allen Iverson, because we just recently heard he was retiring. And now he may not be?
So he played for the 76ers for a long time.
Right.
He was a star
NBA
in Georgetown.
All-star.
Exactly. He was an all-star. He was an MVP. He led his team to the finals. Then he went to the Pistons. Then he went to Denver. Then he went to Memphis. And then he was like, I'll play
for
anybody.
Wants him,
exactly.
Yeah.
Now the 76ers are interested in him again. Yesterday they had a two-hour meeting, and we don't know yet what the results were, but perhaps Allen Iverson will be a 76er again.
Once again, he'd probably be happy to do that. Thanks, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, for that sports
day. Wait, Ibrahim, stay, okay? Yep. You're going to check this out. All right, it's not about sports. It's about you talking yesterday about your impending nuptials, okay? Mm-hmm. A lot of listeners are weighing in on your hunt to find a conflict-free engagement ring for your fiancé. Yesterday, Takeaway contributor Beth Kobliner gave you this advice.
If you want to find a diamond that's from a place that's not abusing people or they're not those other issues that we've been talking about, then you're going to have to do some homework.
And you've been doing the homework, right? And
definitely.
You described a little bit of this process. We've been getting lots of personal stories from people wanting to share how they avoided it. Nicole from Brooklyn emails mytakeitthetakeaway.org. My husband was shopping for our engagement ring last year. He knew I didn't want a new diamond for fear of contributing to the conflict diamond market. He decided on an antique ring. For me, it was the best choice.
And one of you thinks you should just avoid buying diamonds altogether. Rick writes to our site, thetakeaway.org. The diamond engagement ring is nothing more than a marketing scheme embraced by American women who measure their material haves with their girlfriends. My man loves me 2 carats. Yeah, well, my man loves me more for 4 carats. And in case you missed last Sunday's 60 Minutes, can Ibrahim be sure his gold is not from the Congo?
That was great. Did you see that story?
I did. You heard that story. Yeah.
It's interesting. It's about conflict gold from the Eastern Congo.
Do you know where your gold came from?
It's very disturbing, but I don't know where it came from.
All right. Here's an idea from Rena, who writes to our site. My boyfriend and I didn't want to buy into any of the stereotypes at all, so we bought recycled gold bands from Green Carrot and proposed to each other. We are now engaged after a sweet, mosquito-bitten personal ceremony in a buggy bog.
That was my advice to Ibrahim, is go check out
bog?
Green Carrot. You can keep this conversation going. Let us know what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
What did you do in the end, Ibrahim?
Well, I ended up getting a non-conflict diamond, and now I just had to give it to her.
All right. Yeah. Hope she says yes to you.
Coming up, you seems like your premiums won't go up under the proposed health care bill. We're going to talk about the numbers from the Congressional Budget Office in a moment.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Costing out health care, that's coming up. It may not be as expensive as you think. Right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. President Obama is expected to send about 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan, bringing the total American force there to roughly 100,000. The plan will also include an exit strategy that the president will lay out tonight at a speech from West Point at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Seattle police say they have fatally shot the man suspected of gunning down 4 police officers in a coffee shop over the weekend. The suspect, Maurice Clemens, was shot to death in a working-class Seattle neighborhood this morning after police tracked him down using possible hiding spots supplied by local investigators. Thousands of unemployed Americans are facing a potential health care crisis because a federal subsidy to the COBRA plan ends today. It allows workers to keep their health insurance plan after they leave their jobs, but if the subsidy is not extended, the cost of premiums without COBRA would rise 3 times as high.
The couple who made their way uninvited into a White House state dinner deny that they are party crashers. Speaking on the Today Show last hour, Tarek Salahi said he has great respect for President Obama and...
We're going to continue to cooperate and the truth will soon come out.
But also on the Today Show was White House spokesman Robert Gibbs.
This wasn't a misunderstanding. You don't show up at the White House as a misunderstanding.
Gibbs says the security breach could have serious consequences. General Electric has reached an agreement to buy a 20% stake in NBC Universal, paving the way for GE to sell the network to Comcast, the nation's largest cable provider. Overseas, an Argentine judge overturned a ruling last night that would have allowed the first gay marriage in Latin America. We'll go live to Buenos Aires for a reaction in just a few minutes. And the Salvation Army says someone dropped a gold Krugerrand worth more than $1,000 into a collection kettle.
What a nice person.
Outside of Kmart in Pennsylvania. Yeah, they wrapped it in a dollar bill, perhaps so that, you know, they wouldn't get noticed and commented on.
If you put the Krugerrand in the Kmart Salvation Army thing, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
A spokesman says it's been a morale booster for people who ring bells and also for John Hockenberry. Here's some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
So talk about concrete cost increases regarding health care. That story we just mentioned, COBRA. If you lose your job, your health insurer has to hold on to you as an insured person under a plan called COBRA. It's a subsidy program, and when it ends, your costs go up as much as 300%, and that's an issue that's in Congress today. Also in Congress today is this sort of puzzling statistic. The Congressional Budget Office, in finally giving an analysis to the health care reform bill that the Senate is beginning to debate this week, says that the anticipated cost increases for most Americans who have employee-owned health care programs is minimal. And they're looking at 2016, so even the idea of these cost increases is years and years away. Who's going to pay more for health care reform? It is a nearly trillion-dollar bill. Todd Zwillick joins us, Takeaway Washington correspondent. He's in Washington, D.C. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning, John. How are you?
We also have a friend, Takeaway listener, a speech pathologist from New Jersey named Melanie, who's on the line. Melanie, are you there?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. You've been following all this closely. Hold on, let me ask a question of Todd and then get to your concerns and see if Todd can help set us straight. First of all, Todd Zwillick, it appears that very few people, if any, according to the Congressional Budget Office, are going to be literally paying more for health care under this bill. Is that a good thing or some form of camouflage here?
Well, it's very, very complicated, and in fact, the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, made pains to describe how complicated it was. There are some people who will pay more, but not most people. What CBO basically said is anyone who gets their insurance from a large employer, a big company, and in this case, that's defined as anyone who works at a company with 50 or more people and gets insurance from their employer, basically no effect or a slight decrease. That's the projection.
I'm looking at the numbers. That's 5 out of 6. Americans?
That's 5 out of 6 people. That's about that's most people in America today. Now, if you work at a small company, 50 or fewer people, and you get your insurance there, maybe a company with 40 people, again, no effect. Maybe down a tick, maybe up a tick. And this is, by the way, in the year 2016. They only tried to guess out to the year 2016 after all of the insurance changes take effect. Now, the place where you might be affected the most is if you're a person who buys insurance now on your own, like you're self-employed, you're a freelancer, or your employer doesn't offer you coverage. If you're one of those people, you stand a good chance of paying quite a bit less out on the market.
Really?
You stand a good chance of paying less. About 60% of those people who get their insurance by themselves now, that might be about 20 or 22 million people, might pay a bit less. But some of them, John, might pay a bit more. There's an estimated 14 million people out there who could pay more. And real quickly, here's the difference. What the Congressional Budget Office said is if you're one of these people who buys their own coverage, the cost of your premiums, how much you pay for coverage, that's likely to go up. Probably about 10 to 13%. The cost of that coverage is going to go up. But 60% of those people also qualify for a lot of government subsidies and tax credits that are in this bill. So while the price goes up, the taxpayers are going to give you money to pay for it.
I see.
So that your bottom line is going to go way down, even half the price.
And of
However,
course, we're not calculating increased taxes in this.
For everybody else. Yeah. If you're one of the people who doesn't qualify for subsidies, you probably make more than $80,000.
Okay.
Your cost could go up by about that 10%. However, the Democrats say you get more for your money. The coverage under the law has to be better. They can't drop you. They have
to
cover more things. So there's no free lunch, but you get more if you pay more.
All right, Melanie, what is your chief concern in listening to Todd and to all of the healthcare coverage that we've had here on this program and around the nation?
My main concern is that I'm afraid that I'm going to be paying more for subpar healthcare. Like right now, I'm paying more for the company I work with for less than what I was getting before. So I'm paying more for less coverage. And I'm concerned about shouldering the cost for everyone else who can't afford health care. I understand what Todd is saying, but it almost seems too good to be true. Like, who's going to eat the cost of this in the end? If it's the freelance people, then actually they can't afford that much in the end anyway. So I don't really understand why they're doing it and why the wealthier aren't able to shoulder the cost instead of everyone else.
All right. Todd, do you have something for Melanie here?
Well, the money is coming from taxpayers, and what the House and Senate bills are different, but it comes from a couple of places. One, some big cuts to the Medicare program, to parts of the Medicare program. Now, if you're a senior citizen listening to this, we haven't talked about you yet. Your basic benefits not changing, but some parts of Medicare Advantage, that they're taking a couple of $100 billion out of that program. That's how they're getting money for this. If you're a person who has what's called a Cadillac insurance plan. These are very high cost, very rich, really, really nice insurance plans. John, these are becoming passe pretty
quickly because
Congress wants to tax these. You're going to be paying more your employer will be paying more in taxes to carry these plans. So that's where they're trying to get the money. The idea here is to keep the tax increases away from the middle class if you can. Democrats say that's their whole point. Now,
let's get back to Melanie just for a second, Todd. Now, Melanie, it sounds as though the Congressional Budget Office is specifically saying to you that you're not going to pay more in 2016. Either you don't believe them or you think they're just trying to get your vote and things will change by the time we get to 2016.
Honestly, I'm not sure if I believe them, and I think they're trying to get my vote, so it's a combination of the two. It just seems too good to be true. Like, no one's going to have an increase except the the right people. I just can't see that working in the end.
All right, Melanie, so thanks so much. Takeaway listener from New Jersey. Todd, before we go, I mean, this is the challenge for Congress, convincing people like Melanie that it's going to be okay.
It's the big challenge. Healthcare affects everybody. Melanie is right to be concerned because it'll be another 8 or 10 years before we see any of these effects. Some of these politicians might not be in office then. So she's right to be concerned about it. And you got to keep your eye on the ball and call your member of Congress.
Well, what we can be certain that the takeaway here is Melanie's voice is going to be in that healthcare reform debate. Her concern and her trust of Congress. It's a question.
Mistrust, right?
They have to convince her. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much. Coming up, looking for work in all the pink slip wrong places? It's actually a strategy.
Or right places. Yeah.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. We were expecting to be talking about the first gay marriage ceremony ever in Latin America right now. It was scheduled for today in Buenos Aires, Argentina. But as the happy couple were being fitted for tuxedos yesterday, an Argentine judge issued an order blocking the continent's first gay marriage. The two men, Jose Maria de Bello and Alex Freyer, were granted a marriage license by a judge last week, and their planned ceremony today has drawn a strong rebuke from the Catholic Church in Argentina. Here's what Jose had to say about it.
We want the same rights and the same name because our family is equally to the other family.
We were joined earlier this morning by the BBC's South America correspondent, Candice Piet. She spoke with us from Buenos Aires about the reaction there among the populace and whether there was strong support for this couple to marry.
In recent years, big cities like Buenos Aires have become very liberal and relaxed places, and people don't really care. I mean, there's lots of other issues, social issues, that seem more important to Argentines. And so people were very much in favor, as long as people are happy and together. And as one person told me in one of the dance hall I went to go and visit the other night, they were saying, well, if it's less of a pressure on the state if people are together and looking after each other.
So what is the reaction today? Are you hearing from Argentinians today now that they've found out that a judge has blocked this marriage?
Well, it's all over the papers this morning. All the papers have it as one of their lead stories. A lot of speculation about why it's happened and who's behind it. One of the newspapers, for example, Clarín, interviewed two lawyers who said they represent Catholic families concerned about this. You remember that the Catholic Church is very powerful here in Argentina, and that it's them who've applied to the judge to get this wedding blocked. And, of course, the Archbishop of Buenos Aires in the past, Cardinal Bergoglio, has said he's against the marriage and that he considers it unconstitutional. So there's a lot of discussion now about this, and it in a sense, there's concern that this we may be seeing quite big protests on the street, particularly from the gay community today.
Well, backseat quarterback this for us. The mayor had originally stepped out of the way and decided not to appeal the decision to let the gay marriage go forward. Do you think that eventually this will go through despite the opposition of the Catholic Church?
The gay communities say they will be appealing, that this is only a delay. It's a question of legal interpretation of constitutional law. They think it will go through.
And what about the other countries? I mean, very quickly, are there other countries in Latin America that may move forward with this issue?
It's certainly something that's being looked at by gay communities all over the region. But there's nobody in particular. There are some same civil unions allowed in Mexico City, for example, in some Mexican and Brazilian states. And Uruguay also has legalized civil unions. So a lot of interest and about this particular case as a precedent.
That was Candice Piette, a South America correspondent for our partner, the BBC, speaking with us from Buenos Aires about what was supposed to be the very first gay marriage on the continent. It was blocked by a judge's order late yesterday afternoon.
Good morning, John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, we're going to talk about your work life, as we do every Tuesday, but we're explaining that if you're looking for a new job, you might look in the pink slips. Companies that are firing sometimes are also hiring. It's some strategic advice from Beth Koblenner. But right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. The manhunt is over in the Seattle area. A sheriff's spokesman says Seattle police have fatally shot the man suspected of killing four police officers over the weekend. Suspect Maurice Clemens had a long prison record and was released on bail only last week. Seattle police officer Brian Wirtz said he should have been kept in jail.
We've got to hold these people accountable. We've got to keep them locked up. And if they want to rehabilitate them, you can rehabilitate them. But you rehabilitate them in prison, where they're supposed to be. This guy should have never been on the street.
Maurice Clemens was shot and killed early today in a Seattle working-class neighborhood.
President Obama will outline his Afghan strategy tonight. Speaking on The Takeaway, Genevieve Chase, who was a sergeant in the U.S. Army in Afghanistan in 2006, says the Afghan people want an increase in U.S. forces.
For the most part, they feel that if we're not there to continue to support them, that they will be overwhelmed by the Taliban again and that they won't be able to sustain any type of security.
President Obama will announce details of his Afghanistan strategy tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern. It's World AIDS Day, and South African President Zuma has announced he'll get an HIV test as part of a push to remove the stigma from the disease. The BBC's South Africa correspondent Karen Allen reports from Johannesburg.
President Zuma's announcement that he'd been tested for the virus in the past and would undergo another HIV test soon marks a break with the previous administration and places him as an unlikely champion in the AIDS debate. Ridiculed in the past for testifying in court that he took a shower after having sex with an HIV-positive woman, he's now calling on South Africans to behave responsibly and practice safe sex. His predecessor, Thabo Mbeki, was widely condemned for brushing off medical orthodoxy linking HIV to AIDS and denying tens of thousands of South Africans access to life-saving drugs. Now, in what AIDS activists are describing as a second chance for South Africa, Jacob Zuma announced an escalation in treatment programs targeting infants and pregnant women.
That was the BBC's Southern Africa correspondent, Karen Allen, from Johannesburg.
Good morning, everyone. Today we talk about work on The Takeaway, and a lot of you aren't working. 10.2%, that's the unemployment rate for last month, and it's expected to rise at the end of this week when we get the November unemployment rate. October, 10.2. November, we'll find out. It's expected to rise. But where do you look for jobs? In some sense, the best place to look, to look at what's going on in the job market, is to look at those firings, people who are actually getting laid off, which is a sign of who might be getting hired in other parts, even of the same company. A lot of people to talk about this. Beth Koblenner, of course, Takeaway contributor and author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s, in our studio as usual. Good morning, Beth.
Good morning.
And Pamela Watson joins us, a career consultant and professional resume writer at Beacon Career Management. She joins us from Hightstown, New Jersey. Good morning, Pamela.
Good morning.
I want to play for both of you a little cut of tape from someone named Alan Stisna, who was recently hired at a company, and he believes this was due to him watching very, very carefully who was being fired at the very same company.
Hi, my name is Alex Stisna. I'm a program manager for an up-and-coming telecommunications company. Recently, I've had a chance to score a great job in this market that seems to be affecting everyone. The company I work for right now went through some massive layoffs 6 to 8 months ago, and now we're growing, looking for the opportunity in our area to grow. And I am a professional with a background in information technology, and they're looking to have or utilize my skill set.
So, Beth Koblenner, how is this different from the situation when I was working in a factory where the last fired would be the first hired? That basically a kind of a seniority situation where you'd get rehired by your company when they get back to work.
Totally different world right now, because what companies are doing is they're viewing this bad market as a chance to either time to update talent or looking for less expensive employees to hire in place of people who maybe were somewhat more expensive. Also, companies are retrenching. They're not just, you know, getting rid of employees, but they're switching their business models. Instead of being a, you know, focusing only on books, maybe they're focusing on the online division, only, you know, focusing on the store retail. They're looking to, again, some technology aspect of a business. And I think that is the thing people have to realize. It's not just, it's not sort of the vulture going through the obituaries, looking through, you know, to find a great apartment in a city. It's really a change in the business, and that gives you an opportunity, even though it's depressing to read about all these, you know, layoffs, there might be opportunity in that.
Can you be successful doing this?
Absolutely. I think there is a lot of opportunity. I think that the other big thing to keep in mind is geographic. You know, a lot of times companies are laying off. For example, you know, Tyson, the company, laid off workers in Kansas and Nebraska last year, but then they were hiring in Iowa and Arkansas. You know, there are more extreme examples where IBM was laying off a bunch of workers in the U.S., but they were willing to help people move to India, which is a really big change. But if there's geographic change, and then there's also the type of job that they're offering is changing as well.
Well, Pamela, short of moving to Bangalore, is this a piece of a larger puzzle of trying to figure out where the job market is headed? Or is it actually something you could use like Craigslist to find a job?
It's a piece, because what I would highly caution those who take this particular strategy is that the key is really to know and have a good network, so that perhaps you're able to get the background or the backstory related to the downsizing. Typically, companies that have gone through downsizing begin to do, as Beth indicated, do the retrenching, sort of looking to get a different type of talent pool. And if your network is there and pretty strong and able to give you some information and insight, this is one strategy that you can consider and use creatively.
Okay, so Beth, I was the one that initially thought this sounds, for the person who was laid off, this sounds like going through the obituaries to try and find yourself an apartment in New York. But maybe you're saying this is a way to make lemons out of lemonade. So for the person who is laid off, can they, if the person that's laid off from Tyson, can they then retrench themselves and move reapply to Tyson in a new capacity? How do the person who's laid off make this to their advantage?
Right. Well, I think you bring up an excellent point, and I think that's the problem. What some companies are doing, if they're laying off a little bit more expensive workers, they might be hiring a next round of workers who are less expensive. But they typically don't go to their employers and say, you know, they are doing some pay cuts and some furloughs, but they may not go to that same that old employee and say, would you take this job for half the pay? So it can get very demoralizing to not only the person who was laid off, but the people who are remaining. Hey, why'd they let off Joe? He was great, and they hired somebody new. So it can, you know, be very, very tricky, I think.
But Pamela Watson, I mean, if you have the espionage within your company that, okay, they're laying off at Factory A, all right, where you happen to live, and that's going to include your job, but you're pretty convinced that over at Factory B on the other side of the country, they're going to be hiring. I mean, if you show up at Factory B as old Fred Gillespie and offer to take a job for less, I mean, are they going to really look at you attractively in that situation, Pamela?
I think so, mainly because you're bringing perhaps skills and experiences that match with what the company is needing. The idea is really to market yourself appropriately so that there's a good match. And a company will value that, and you've got a great opportunity to get a new position.
And, of course, we should say a lot of people can't relocate, right?
Absolutely. So. I mean, I think this isn't the end-all, be-all answer, but I think it's sort of demoralizing when you're hearing about all these layoffs and you're hearing about all this cutbacks in companies, and you say, I'm going to steer clear of this. You know, but then if you just look at, you hear that, you know, Aetna announced a couple of weeks ago laying off 625 employees. You look on the website, they're advertising for 100 employees.
Wow. In a different department?
Different areas.
Well, you
different
know,
areas.
We should do a segment one of these weeks about relocating.
Uh-huh.
About the difficulty of that, because there are opportunities out there, clearly.
Yeah, and that's been talk about relocating.
Yeah.
There we go. And that's been on a huge upswing.
Beth Koblenner, Takeaway contributor and author of Get a Financial Life, thank you. And thanks to Pamela Watson, career consultant in Hightstown. Allentown, New Jersey.
So we're not just following the pink slips. We're also following the troops into Afghanistan. Tonight, President Obama explains his strategy for that country. And we want to get a kind of a level on what you're thinking about all this.
This is Gordon from Salt Lake City, Utah. In all of the comparison of Afghanistan to Vietnam, I've not seen any mention of the invasion of Cambodia. I liken Obama's speech tonight to that sort of event, that we've got to get more in and do more in order to win, or at least withdraw.
That's an interesting point of view. What's your point of view about it? Are you hoping that the president talks about an exit strategy or plans for diplomacy in the region? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeofthetakeaway.org.
I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
The orders have gone out. The commander-in-chief heads for West Point.
The president will reiterate the importance of why we're there, but also, by all means, very early on, acknowledge the tremendous cost and sacrifice to our men and women in uniform.
The bright-eyed young West Point cadets of today were in grade school when George W. Bush delivered a speech at the academy back in 2002 at the beginning of the Afghanistan war. Today, President Obama lays out his strategy on Afghanistan to a class that has grown up with two wars.
We are on our way to West Point. We're your perfect long cousin. He'll throw his hat up in the air.
Talking hard truth to the two war cadets. We're on our way to West Point on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. Tuesday, December 1st. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Good morning, Celeste.
Good morning, John. Coming up this hour, we're going to get the latest details about the shooting in Washington. Police there say they have shot dead the suspect in the killing of four police officers over the weekends. Also, colleges trying to address rape on campus and not doing it entirely successfully and giving justice to women. Also, who's spending what in Washington? Not federal programs, pencils and bottled water. We're going to check on receipts in just a moment.
But first, retired Colonel Jack Jacobs joins us from West Point this morning. Colonel, you teach politics at West Point. How does having grown up with two wars change or season these West Point cadets that the president will be speaking to tonight?
Well, they view themselves as professional soldiers. 9/11/2001, they were very, very young. They have known nothing but war and the prospect of going to war, but they view themselves as professional soldiers and are ready to go.
Being ready to go and being not as wide-eyed as they might have been pre-9/11, does that make them more accountable, that President Barack Obama is in a sense being held more accountable by the cadets in this class at West Point?
Oh, I think so. He is the commander-in-chief, after all, and whatever he says goes. But in the end, their perception about the value of their service transcends any decisions that are made by the president. But they do want him to act like a commander, tell him exactly what he wants them to accomplish so that they can go ahead and do it.
And we'll all be listening. Retired Colonel Jack Jacobs teaches politics at West Point, where the president will be laying out his strategy for Afghanistan later tonight. And coming up, we're going to talk about who else is paying attention to that speech around the world. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
Seattle police say they've killed the man suspected of gunning down four police officers in a coffee shop over the weekend. A police spokesman says a single officer found the suspect, Maurice Clemens, and shot and killed him after tracking him down using possible hiding spots supplied by local investigators. President Obama, as we said, will unveil his new strategy for Afghanistan tonight, including an expected 30,000 to 35,000 troop increase. The first wave of Marines will reportedly be sent to the Kandahar region, a Taliban stronghold. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs says the plan will also include an exit strategy.
This is not an open-ended commitment. We are there to partner with the Afghans, to train the Afghan National Security Forces, the Army and the police.
U.S. allies in NATO are expected to confirm an additional 5,000 troops as well. And the couple who made their way uninvited into a White House state dinner deny that they are party crashers. They spoke on the Today Show this morning, and Tarek Salahi says the truth will come out in time and prove they did not crash the party.
The Senate battle over health care is in full swing. Majority Leader Harry Reid took to the Senate floor in an effort to reach out to Republicans who remain united in their opposition. General Electric removed an obstacle to selling its NBC Universal media business to cable giant Comcast. It agreed to buy French conglomerate Vivendi's 20% stake. Vivendi was holding out for more money, a cool $250 million. They got it. After finishing the best month since the summer, the Dow opens at 10,344. The S&P is 5 points under 1,100, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,144. Tonight, President Obama explains his strategy for Afghanistan. We want to take the pulse of what you'll be listening for. Are you looking for an exit strategy? His plans for diplomacy? How much will you focus on the number of troops involved? You know how to reach us, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, Pakistan listens in.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. It's a hugely important moment tonight, and it will be an audience literally at attention when the president strides out to address the cadets at West Point this evening. And Barack Obama will also have the world's attention as he lays out his policy, discusses tactics, an exit strategy, we understand, and in many ways outlines the fate for many of those West Point cadets who will no doubt deploy to Afghanistan at some point over the next few years. Also paying close attention will be NATO allies being asked to increase their troop commitments in Afghanistan. But perhaps most directly affected beyond the West Point cadets and active duty officers is Pakistan, where the danger of escalation on one side of the border brings possible tension and escalation on the other side. Secretary of State Clinton addressed this issue directly a few weeks ago.
You can't just play whack-a-mole. You can't just knock down the Taliban somewhere and expect you're done, because they have, unfortunately, created this syndicate, this network of interconnected terrorist groups. And so the Pakistanis have to be vigilant.
Joining us now is Hassan Abbas, a Bernard Schwartz Fellow at the Asia Society and a senior advisor at the Harvard Kennedy School at Harvard University. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Thank you.
So, Hassan, it's been said in the past that to think of Afghanistan in isolation from Pakistan or even the rest of the region is a mistake, both militarily and politically. What are you looking for as a sign that President Obama is perhaps not looking at Afghanistan as a battlefield all its own?
I think this has to be seen first in reference to the 1,500-mile-long border between Pakistan and Afghanistan and the Pashtuns who live on the both sides. And so, for me, the indication will be if the strategy is not purely on Afghanistan, or it's not purely about surge or the number of the military officers, soldiers who will be deployed there, but if there is a component attached to it or coupled with it, which talks about Pakistani side of the border, which talks about the ordinary people who are on both sides of that Durand line, a line which is in the air. In the Western world, we think of borders and states. In that region, there's something else which defines nationality, citizenship, identity, especially in that Pashtun area. So if the policy is strictly about the number of troops and there's no additional issues tackled, then that will be a sign of problem to me.
All right. So, Hassan Abbas, let me have you listen to some early indications we're getting of reaction to one of America's closest allies. The British Foreign Secretary, David Miliband, has said his assessment of the president's speech tonight and the new strategy is definitely going to involve both sides of the border. Listen here.
The message coming out of President Obama's speech today, I think, will be that there is going to be a full counterinsurgency strategy on both sides of the Afghan-Pakistan border. And that is something that I think is very significant, because it means military pressure on the insurgencies on both sides of the border, but also a thoroughgoing campaign to ensure that the people of Afghanistan and of Western Pakistan have something to look forward to and a loyalty to their own state, which is at the heart of any successful counterinsurgency.
How do people of Pakistan not look at a statement like that and think that the Obama administration is bringing the war into Pakistan, Hassan Abbas?
The war, frankly, is already across the border. I mean, in the last 3 years, this year alone, there have been about 110 suicide attacks in Pakistan in major cities. Last year, 69 attacks. Previous year to that, 61 attacks. But I will add one further component to this, which is that it's about regional politics as well. There's this concern about Pakistani policy, the military policy, that they have not been doing enough in that region because they believe that India has its increasing influence in Afghanistan, and they consider in Afghanistan as their backyard. And they believe that so long as India is increasing its infrastructure, its allies within Afghanistan, somehow that will be counterproductive for Pakistan's interests. That will be another sign of interest and of a comprehensive policy. But you're right, Pakistanis already think of thousands of the people in the tribal area and federally administered tribal area, they believe that Pakistan military and Pakistani law enforcement agencies are fighting this war on behalf of U.S., which is not exactly the case because these militants were groomed, sponsored in that region for a long time, and Pakistan itself, its military, its security agencies are responsible partly for all of this. So they know that they're already in the war, but one additional sign will be whether there is a regional policy involved, not only in the Pakistan-Afghanistan border region, but vis-a-vis Pakistan-India-Afghanistan nexus.
Well, that begs the question, Hassan Abbas, that the president has said that his strategy is to send more troops in and to train a strong, independent Afghan army. But this isn't just an army in Afghanistan that needs to be strong and independent. It also has to be allied with the Pakistan army, and they have to work in conjunction. Is that going to work?
That would be ideal in the long sense, in the long term. Yes, Pakistan and Afghan have so much in common historically. I would not rule that out, that someday their militaries will talk to each other, will cooperate with each other. But the recent history tells us something different, which is that the Afghan army, despite a lot of investment, a lot of effort, has not been trained up to the international standards. The ethnic differences between Pashtuns, Tajiks, and Uzbeks are so entrenched, and militaries cannot be created just out of the blue. There is a history involved, there is a certain culture involved, and Afghan army is not showing any signs that they can come up to the plate, so to say, in just 2 or 3 years.
And Hassan Abbas, I mean, if I may say, to go into your remarks just a moment ago, the disturbing takeaway there is someday the Afghan army will speak with the Pakistan army. I mean, this does not bode well for anything other than continued civil war along the border.
Yes, that civil war has now converted into an insurgency. And that's, we are talking about an area which is mountainous, which is, the terrain is very difficult. Both the militaries have never been really established or based in that region. So it's not going to be only about military, it's about the counterinsurgency policy and the strategy and the regional aspects to it. But of course, law enforcement agencies also have to be strengthened. It's not only military increase of which will resolve this issue.
Hassan Abbas is the Bernard Schwartz Fellow at the Asia Society in New York, outlining the formidable regional challenges for President Obama as he speaks at West Point tonight. He's also a senior advisor at the Kennedy School at Harvard University. And now at 15 minutes past the hour, let's take a look at some of the headlines we're following this morning.
Thousands of unemployed Americans who've been getting federal help with health insurance payments are on their own today. A federal subsidy to the COBRA plan contained in the economic stimulus bill is ending. COBRA is the program that allows workers to keep their company's health insurance after they've lost their jobs. Alleged state dinner party crasher Tarek Salahi was on the Today Show this morning. Salahi said he and his wife did nothing wrong and complained about being labeled as party crashers. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs was also on NBC's Today Show this morning. He was not impressed with Salahi's explanation.
This wasn't a misunderstanding. You don't show up at the White House as a misunderstanding.
The couple who allegedly came to last week's state dinner uninvited say they will continue to cooperate with the Secret Service.
Search engine Yahoo has revealed the top most searched subjects of this year. It's getting to be a sort of digital 21st century ritual, you know. Michael Jackson's death, not surprisingly, is number one. But the surprising thing is that it toppled Britney Spears as the most searched person on Yahoo for the first time in guess how many years?
7 years.
Twilight, the teen vampire saga, is number two searched item. Google will release its top search list for 2009 later this month. Britney Spears, beware. Those are some of the stories we're following today. Coming up, who in Congress is spending taxpayer money to buy, say, 5,700 bottles of water? instead of just using the water fountains that the taxpayers built long ago. Capitol Hill has posted the receipts of lawmakers online, and Todd Zwillick joins us for Who Spent and Who Gave more in a few minutes.
What's wrong with the water fountain?
No, use it instead of the bottled water.
Absolutely. That's what I mean. Right, exactly. I mean, it's good water.
Hey, you want that to go?
News takeouts now for stories we want you to stay on top of this week. And at the takeout counter this morning, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen here in the studio, and Louise Story from our partner, The New York Times, also joins us.
Good morning.
Todd, let's begin with you. I mean, this 4,000-page disclosure of expense receipts in Congress has to be like Treasure Island for you.
Oh,
what did you find? What have you got there?
It's fantastically mundane and yet a great window into how Congress works. Well, it takes about $1.4 million a year to run a congressional office if you're a rank-and-file member.
Right.
Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, spends that in one quarter. So this was a quarterly report just July 1st through September 30th of this year. So Speaker Pelosi, and we're talking about trips to Office Depot, paying the phone bill, keeping the lights on. This does not include the motorcade, the security, the flights on her Air Force jet to get back and forth to California.
All right, so just in terms of Office Depot, paperclip kinds of expenses, who's thrifty and who's egregious?
Well, they all spend just about the same. It doesn't appear that Congress has cut back too much in this bad economy on their trips to Office Depot and in paying employees. But I'll tell you what's not thrifty. You mentioned in your teaser there before, John, I did a search and noticed 5,752 separate line items for bottled water just in one quarter in the House of Representatives. Now, I know that people have to drink water. You know, they have bottles of water in the committee rooms. Everybody loves to drink water, and you should drink lots of water. But there are plenty of water fountains around there. So I'm not sure about 5,752 separate purchases for water.
There are. I've been to Congress. There's water fountains. It seems like every 100 feet or so.
Well, I don't know if the bottled water scandal will make it onto 60 Minutes, but that's a good point there. It's a good point.
It might not.
What else? Do any members of Congress deserve a real sort of shout-out for being thrifty here?
Well, there are half a dozen guys who called pest control for one reason or another. I'll say that. But there are two members of Congress who deserve some props. Spencer Bacus, a Republican of Alabama, and Tim Walz, Democrat of Minnesota, together sent checks to the U.S. Treasury, to you and me, for $2,470 for deficit reduction. They wrote checks from their own money to cut the deficit. Here's a gift, taxpayers, to lower the deficit. I think they deserve a little bit of props on
that. And that was their leftover expenses that they didn't spend on bottled water and paper clips, right?
or they just decided to take it out of the water budget or the pencil budget. Who knows where they got it, they did us all a favor, I guess.
Well, keep working through those 4,000 pages. Todd's with Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks, Todd.
And now we'll go to business with Louise Story, Wall Street and finance reporter for partner in the New York Times. And Louise, I'm disheartened because you've come in a couple times, including recently, saying you were surprised at how tough the financial regulatory reform was looking, that you were shocked at how tough they were going to be on these banks. And now what's happened? It's all gone straight out the window?
I have been shocked by different provisions that have come out in subcommittees. But the question that's kind of looming is anything going to actually get to the level of a House, a full House vote, a full Senate vote, make it into law? You know, I'm wondering if some of these people on the Hill are so busy buying bottled water that they're not getting it done. But there are three main areas that have really been weakened or had stumbling blocks in financial reform. One would be this Consumer Protection Agency that's been...
Barney Frank has been talking about it a lot.
That's right. But it's been dramatically weakened, and a number of banks, a large majority of small banks, have been pulled out from under it. Another area we've seen things really loosened are the proposals for derivatives reforms. Those are those complex assets that people have been worried about during the crisis. And then also, at one point, we were talking about the Fed being the systemic risk regulator with kind of a Zeus-like power to jump in anywhere and find a problem. But there's so many people in Washington who don't particularly like the Fed right now that they don't want to give it all that many powers, but they don't have any regulator they like to give the powers to.
So there'll be no risk regulator in this bill?
That's pretty huge. They're talking about a potential council of regulators. They're talking about giving the Fed powers over a handful of big banks, but they've really hemmed it in. And I think what's going on is that people do not fully understand what caused this crisis. And that has led to a lot of hemming and hawing about what we should really do. And, you know, you have a couple committees in Washington that are still holding investigations into what even happened. The permanent subcommittee in the Senate's not going to come out with their findings for maybe more than a year. So it could be that we have to wait. You know, after the 1929 stock crash, we did not get that big reform in the 30s until 1933 and 1936. Okay. So it might be that we're a few years off.
Okay, we'll see. Luis Story, Wall Street and finance reporter for The New York Times.
Thank
Guess
you.
What? We're going to have to wait. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen does not have to wait to hear the reaction of our audience. We spoke yesterday about Tiger Woods, right? His difficulties over the weekend. Here's a response from one of our listeners.
This is Peter from New York City. I think it's none of our business what happens in Tiger Woods' private life, and shame on you for ratcheting up the drama, just like CNN or Fox.
And Chris emailed us, have you considered the possibility that Mr. Woods and his wife may have decided that allowing the police and the media into their family affairs would have a negative effect on them? Now, we talked about Tiger Woods as a role model yesterday. He's pulled out of a tournament that he sponsors. What do you make of this strong reaction from listeners?
Well, I was interested in the comment by Peter because it wasn't just CNN and Fox that had it as a lead. It was actually lead on BBC yesterday as well. The entire world is talking about Tiger Woods, and is Tiger Woods the golden boy or no longer the golden boy? So, you know, I think that this is a major story because of his stature. He's as big as Pele. He's as big as Muhammad Ali because he's the major face of the sport.
But we should say Tiger Woods didn't do anything wrong.
I think it's more of the fact that we don't know what happened. And him pulling out of this tournament is interesting. The reason why it's interesting to me is because he said it's because of the injuries associated with the accident. He's been injured before he had his ACL surgery, which put him out of contention last year. He was hurting. He was hurting
right.
for most of the year. He won a tournament. He played hurt.
Yeah.
So we know Tiger is a tough guy. So for him to pull out, I think it's more about him saving face than less about him being injured.
Saving face, and facial injuries are what he's believed to have, quite literally. Well, we should note before we go, though, that legally, Tiger Woods doesn't have to do anything.
He doesn't have to do
there
anything.
There is no charge. There is no complaint.
He's done nothing wrong.
And he does have fans and people that look up to him, so it would be great to hear from him.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor, thanks so much. Coming up, authorities say they have fatally shot the man suspect for killing four cops in Tacoma, Washington. We'll get the latest from Washington State in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, a community in distress this morning. Four police officers shot down in a coffee shop in Tacoma, Washington this weekend. And now the Seattle police officers say the suspect in the case has been killed himself by another officer. We'll have the latest in a few moments. But first, here's some of the other stories we're following at 30 minutes past the hour. President Obama is unveiling his Afghan strategy tonight, which is expected to include roughly 30,000 additional troops. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs explains that the first new Marines will be in the Kandahar region, a Taliban stronghold, by Christmas.
Once that area is cleared, that area then has to be held. Ultimately, the strategy will be to transfer the security responsibility of an area to the Afghans.
The president will meet with more than 30 members of Congress this afternoon before heading to West Point to address the nation. Thousands of unemployed Americans may lose their health insurance today. That's because of a federal subsidy to the COBRA plan that runs out tonight. Without it, the premiums will jump up by hundreds of dollars per month for the unemployed who managed to hold on to their insurance after they left their jobs. And the couple who showed up uninvited to a White House state dinner says, "We've got the story all wrong." Tarek Salahi told NBC's Today Show they did not crash the party at the White House.
This has been the most devastating thing that's ever happened to us. We're greatly saddened by all the circumstances that have been involved in portraying my wife and I as party crashers. And I can tell you we did not party crash the White House.
Salahi went on to say that the truth will come out.
So new evidence that the stimulus package may have saved some jobs. The Congressional Budget Office is estimating that the plan sustained between 600,000 and 1.5 million jobs in the third quarter. Wall Street is open and the markets are rising. The Dow is up about 1%. To worries about Dubai, apparently well in the rearview mirror of investors this morning. Those are some of the stories we're following.
Breaking news this morning, the man suspected of gunning down four police officers in a suburban Seattle coffee shop has been killed by a lone Seattle patrol officer investigating a stolen car earlier this morning. Reaction over this entire incident among the community is shock.
The chief knows I'm not very politically correct, but I have to be to a point. I can't believe he was out on the street. If what is true, I think this country needs to get together and figure out why these people are out.
That's police officer and local union president Brian Wirtz. And here's some of the voices from the rest of the members of the community in Tacoma, Washington.
I can't imagine how he was able to get four of them, you know, and kill them all. Just, the guy had an agenda.
He knew. He had to have known that four cops were there, or at least some cops were there, to just go in there and shoot them like he did. That's just wrong.
It's pretty bold.
Yeah,
pretty bold.
For the latest updates on the story, we have Patricia Murphy with us. She's a reporter for KUOW Radio in Seattle, Washington. Good morning, Patricia.
Good morning.
Do we have confirmation that the suspect, Maurice Clemens, was shot this morning by a lone police officer?
Yes. In fact, a Seattle police officer was actually investigating a stolen car when he noticed some movement behind him. He turned and realized that he thought this might be the suspect, Maurice Clemens, and ordered him to stop. He was noncompliant and started to run. Whether there was a struggle or not, we don't know, but he was shot by the police officer and was declared dead by paramedics. He was also seriously wounded from the original shooting.
The incident where one of the police officers that he killed wounded him on his way out of the coffee shop.
Yes, and chillingly, he was carrying one of the handguns from one of those
officers. Of their handguns. Are we expecting, the police have said that he was being helped out by friends and relatives. Are we expecting that we will see more arrests for aiding and abetting?
There have been three people arrested already for allegedly helping him elude police during the search effort. They expect more sometime today and tomorrow.
And what kind of evidence do we know about this suspect? Are we for sure that this is the man responsible?
Well, you know, we don't know that for sure. He is still a suspect. There seems to be some certainty that he was the person. There was some communication between apparently Clemens and some folks that he knew the night before of the shooting, saying that they should watch the news because he was going to kill some cops.
Okay, that's Patricia Murphy of KUOW in Seattle. The city has identified the victims. They are 39-year-old Sergeant Mark Renninger, Ronald Owens, 37-year-old Tina Griswold, and Greg Richards, both 40 and 42. The officers were in uniform. They were wearing bulletproof vests, working on their laptop computers as they prepared to start their shifts. And Clemens himself has an extensive violent criminal history stemming back to Arkansas as a 16-year-old. He was recently arrested and charged in Pierce County, Washington, for third-degree assault on a police officer and second-degree rape of a child. And he was out because he'd been granted clemency by then-Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee. We're joined now by Kate Zernike, national correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Kate, a lot of people are wondering now if this will be Mike Huckabee's Willie Horton. Is this case going to ruin his credibility?
Well, I think this case in many ways is actually worse than the Willie Horton case because we've got four police officers dead. It's played out over national television. This isn't something that happened, you know, in the past. Mike Huckabee has faced this kind of issue before. As governor of Arkansas over a decade, he pardoned or gave clemency to more criminals than his three predecessors combined. And so I think it will definitely be a huge issue for him. He has had this kind of issue before, but the facts of the case were more in dispute.
Here is Mike Huckabee's answer. Here he is speaking on the O'Reilly Factor on Fox News.
And in the case of this particular individual, he was sentenced to 108 years for two crimes when he was 16. The Post-Prison Transfer Board, the process, and I'll be very brief about this, but to understand, they recommended to me as governor for his commutation, which didn't release him. It simply cut his sentence to 47 years. That would give him parole eligibility.
Does that particular argument that Mike Huckabee didn't release him, just gave him the eligibility to be released, is that going to hold water for his political career?
No, I don't think so. I mean, what he's doing in this case is really splitting hairs, and he did that a number of times when he was governor. And this is what all of his critics said, is that when he's criticized on these matters, rather than taking responsibility or some responsibility, because I don't think any one person is responsible, he blames his critics, he blames others. And so I think his reaction is going to be as much the issue as the actual release of this convict.
Well, forgetting about Huckabee for a moment, I mean, how much of this is the judgment of one man versus a real problem in the entire prison system where you have a parole system that is making these kinds of recommendations and an overcrowding situation that puts pressure on people like Maurice Clemens getting out? What do you think, Kate?
That is absolutely true. In any case like this, there are going to be several holes where people can say someone should have done something here. I think why this will be an issue for Huckabee is this is not an isolated case. This was actually, until Sunday, this was a routine clemency for him, for Huckabee. I mean, he's done this thousands of times. There are just any number of cases that could raise issues for him, and that could be a problem if he runs for president.
Okay, Kate. Patricia Murphy in Seattle. I want you to listen to this clip from Lakewood Police Chief Brett Farrar.
One of the questions that I get throughout the day yesterday is, how is everybody doing? This is how everybody's doing. They're here. They're doing their jobs. They're working hard. They're dealing with their loss. But they're here for the citizens. We're here to carry on. This is what we do, and this is where we are good.
And Patricia, quickly, let me ask you, how is everybody doing? How is the community coping with this incredibly tragic event followed by this dramatic manhunt?
Well, you know, I think the police said, this is part of their jobs. Nobody is certainly rejoicing that this guy is dead this morning. There will be no peace for the families of these police officers. There's certainly a lot of community support, but this has been, in reality, the fifth police shooting we've had in a month here in Seattle and in Washington. So there's definitely an edge going on within the police department regarding their safety and what's going on in Seattle and Tacoma.
Thanks. That's Patricia Murphy, KUOW reporter in Seattle. We also heard from Kate Zernike, national correspondent for The New York Times. Thanks to both of you. Coming up, we're going to be talking about rapes and assaults on college campuses and how the strategy by some colleges to deal with it isn't really helping the victims. More on that later this hour.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. Down in Florida, the newspaper there had a basic question to ask. They went and looked at the state lawmakers who are opposing health care reform, and they asked, who's paying for your health insurance? And they got a surprising answer, because as it turns out, in Florida and in six other states, many government employees, including lawmakers and other employees who are making above $100,000, are getting health insurance completely for free. They don't pay any part of their premiums. The state of Florida actually pays $45 million for extremely good, strong health care that is free for these government employees. And we have Beth Reinhardt, a political reporter for the Miami Herald, joining us. Beth, explain to me what the reaction... I mean, you guys had this story in the paper yesterday, but this is a 20-year-old program. So is this just something that's been around for a long time and no one has noticed?
It is one of those little-known perks that state legislators and the governor, members of the cabinet, get. And we thought that the current debate over health care reform in Washington made it, noteworthy, because a lot of the same legislators who are complaining about the potential cost to the state of increasing the Medicaid rolls are the same folks who have been getting free health insurance for years.
Well, Governor Charlie Crist is no friend to health care reform, and yet I was very surprised to see that he's in the process of trying to add on even his own stepdaughters who live with their father in New York City, and he's trying to add them onto the free insurance program, correct?
Right, and that kind of, you know, shows you that, you know, the free subsidies are obviously helping a lot of people who are not as defenders of the program say, you know, lower-paid public, hardworking public bureaucrats, civil servants. I mean, these are the daughters of a socialite millionaire, and they don't even live in the state.
Florida is not the only state that has these kind of benefits. There's also six other states. And what has been the reaction of your readers? Have you heard from anyone to comment on this?
I did get a number of emails yesterday, mostly from people who are either uninsured or really struggling with their insurance company over coverage, and they were outraged, you know, because they, as most of us, have been paying increasing amounts for premiums, and they were shocked to find out that there are people who don't pay a cent.
What kind of deductibles, Beth?
They do have a deductible and a copay, but it's a very generous plan, and what they say is that it makes up for the low pay that some state employees who haven't gotten raises because of the very tight budget, that it makes up for that. Legislators also are not paid as full-time employees. They make about $29,000 a year.
But this, very quickly, we have very little time yet, but that was the essential issue to me, is we're talking about legislators who've given up insurance from their full-time jobs and taken the completely free plan from their part-time job as legislators.
Right. I mean, the idea is to encourage, regular people, regular citizens to become part of the legislature. The truth is that because of the way how costly it is to run for election, many of the legislators are very wealthy people who are, say, partners in a law firm and can afford to, you know, work part-time as a legislator.
Well, this
and
is the essential problem that makes it difficult for legislators in Washington to sell health care reform and have people believe them. That's Beth Reinhardt, political reporter for the Miami Herald. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. Statistics from the Department of Justice. One out of every five college women who are attending college, will be raped or experience an attempted rape before they go to graduation. And how colleges deal with that is a problem. We're going to talk about that more in a few minutes. But first, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. Just out now, the AP is reporting that 30,000 additional troops will be sent to Afghanistan. That has been confirmed from the White House. As we've been talking about this morning, the president will outline his revised Afghanistan war strategy, including an exit strategy, in a speech tonight at West Point. Speaking earlier on The Takeaway, National Guard Specialist Marco Reininger, who served in Afghanistan in 2008, says soldiers on the ground want some clear guidelines from the president.
A clear set of objectives and a clear framework that involves both our military and civilian efforts just makes it much more motivating and to be in an environment like that, because it gives you a goal.
That's National Guard Specialist Marco Reininger speaking earlier on The Takeaway. More details have emerged in the past hour about this morning's operation to shoot and kill Maurice Clemens. That's the suspect in the killings of four police officers in a Tacoma coffee shop on Sunday. Police in Seattle say a lone officer investigating a stolen car came across Clemens, told him to raise his hands. The officer fired on him when he did not do so. A spokesman for the local sheriff's office says they expect to have six or seven people in custody by the end of today. They're thought to have helped Clemens hide from police.
Here, this development in the war on terror. Authorities in India have blocked around 25 million mobile phones, which have no valid unique identification code and can't be traced. Phones without these codes have often been used by militant groups, according to the Indian government. The issue of phones without identification codes has become a sensitive one after last year's Mumbai attacks, in which around 170 people were killed. Voters in Atlanta will choose a new mayor today. The contest may hinge on race, as a white councilwoman faces a black former state senator. Atlanta hasn't had a white mayor in more than 30 years. Turnout is not expected to be high. And Cyber Monday was a hit for online retailers. The day when shoppers are enticed to shop on the internet was lucrative, reportedly. A web analysis company says the online sales were up almost 20% from last year. And those are some of the stories we've been following this morning.
It can be a really exciting time when a kid goes off to college, but for many young people, it's the first time that they're away from home and almost completely unsupervised. And the statistics about college experience is very disturbing. For girls especially, it can be a dangerous situation. According to a report from the Department of Justice, roughly one in five women who attend college will become the victim of a rape or an attempted rape by the time they graduate. And it's surprisingly easy to get away with rape. Arrests are made in only 25% of cases. And on college campuses, the issue's further complicated by college justice systems, which are individual to each school, and they sometimes punish the victims. Kristen Lombardi is with us. She's from the Center for Public Integrity, and she's just finished a three-part investigative journalism piece on this topic. The first part is published on the organization's website today. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning.
First of all, let's talk about these statistics, which are incredible. As I said, one in five women is going to be the victim of a rape or an attempted rape when they go to college. 95% of those women will not report it to the college or the university or to an authority. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
So how widespread is this? Are there areas which are more dangerous? Is it maybe urban colleges? Is there any way places that are safe?
Well, I think those statistics are, you know, across the board nationally. It's very hard to generalize because, as you said in your introduction, each university has its own college judicial system. I really looked at, you know, the college judicial system and how it adjudicates claims of campus sexual assault, because there is such a tiny minority of students who do come forward and who do go through the hearing process.
5%. You actually spoke with one of them. Catherine Russell is talking. She talked to you about the experience she had in which she was raped, and she went to campus authorities to try and get justice.
After I reported the man who attacked me to the university, I was given a brochure and told to go home and think about it, and I had several deans discourage me from following through with the reporting of the crime. I had them tell me that it was a lost cause, that if I talked about how the school trial was going, that I would be expelled or could be expelled because it was a university judicial proceeding.
Let me kind of repeat what she just said. The school told her if she talked about what had happened to her, she would be expelled.
Yes, that is what she says, and that is actually what the education department corroborated, because Catherine is very unusual. She actually, first of all, she went through the process, and at UVA, only 33 students in the last 10 years have gone through the campus judicial process with allegations of rape. But also,
and by the stats, it should be hundreds and hundreds.
Yeah.
Well, UVA is a campus of 21,000. Right now.
It's one out of five of 21,000.
Yeah. So we're talking a tiny, tiny minority who make it to the hearing process. I mean, part of our series was to look at those who get diverted. They actually may come forward, and Catherine sort of alluded this in her answer when she said she was discouraged initially by deans, and we heard that a lot as we went through the investigation.
Well, the University of Virginia responded. They sent us an email that says, one sexual assault on a college campus is one too many. Higher education has had to map its way through how best to deal with these extraordinarily difficult and terrible events. We've listened attentively to our students, both women and men, who've given us valuable perspective. At the University of Virginia, we have to put into place what we believe are best practices by today's standards. But like all universities, we're continually reassessing what we do and making changes where they are needed as soon as they are needed. So it sounds like they are working on a policy. The one thing that struck me, though, in the report when I read it was that you actually had someone from Illinois said that under current law, colleges can release the name of students who are found responsible for committing violent acts, but colleges do not release those. And in fact, in Catherine's case, the young man that she accused went on to be accused of another sexual assault.
Yes. Actually, that was very interesting. I mean, we did file records requests with individual schools based on the cases that we featured, asking for the names of accused students found responsible. And this is something that schools are allowed to release publicly, but nobody released that information.
Why not?
You know, administrators that we talked to basically really... I think part of the problem with the campus judicial system is that it's a confidential and closed process. It's not like your civil or your criminal court process.
Well, it's also a marketing thing. I mean, you're kind of like theme parks where they don't report on injuries at the theme park, or a hospital that doesn't report on mortalities. It's not in their interest. They're incentivized to not report about sexual assaults on campus because students won't go there. Parents won't send their kids there, right?
Well, certainly that's what critics believe. I mean, administrators will argue and justify the confidential process. We are not adjudicating criminal laws. We're not adjudicating crimes. We are adjudicating and deciding whether or not a student's conduct violates our own code. It's an institutional matter. It's not a matter for public consumption, and that's how they see even allegations involving violent acts, which rape obviously
is. I got three girls. I mean, that sounds to me like on campus, a sexual assault is a sort of boys will be boys kind of thing. And out in the community, it's a rape. It's a felony.
Well, certainly there's that dichotomy. And that's one of the things that, you know, struck me when I first started investigating these cases. Why is it that colleges and universities are adjudicating claims of campus sexual assault in the first place? It is a felony crime. Then when it comes down to it, students that are found responsible, I mean, we personally found that punishment is lenient. It's, you know, light academic penalties, suspension if you're lucky. Expulsion is very, very rare. And in the real world, you're talking about, you know, jail time if somebody is found in violation.
And this doesn't, they don't release it. It doesn't end up on their record anyway.
No, it doesn't end up
on
their record.
So they could go on to commit another violent act. We've only seen the very first part of Kristen Lombardi's investigative reporting for the Center for Public Integrity. The rest will be released early next year, and I'm sure we will be checking back in with you, Kristen. Thank you so much. If to get more of that, you can go to our website, or you can go to the website for the Center for Public Integrity.
Thank you.
If you missed anything, we're always on here at The Takeaway. Of course, take our podcast to go, and you can subscribe at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes, the same place Celeste told you to go to hear that interview from Kristen from the Center for Public Integrity. Today, we're looking forward to tonight when President Obama explains his strategy for Afghanistan. We're looking to hear what you are going to be watching for.
This is Craig. Tonight, I'd like to hear Obama speak honestly about Pakistan as well as Afghanistan. Feel like we are simply doing crowd control in Afghanistan, where, from what I've read, most of the Taliban leaders, including bin Laden and others, are all in Pakistan.
And Tom in Bloomfield, New Jersey, emails, if Obama adds 40,000 troops to Afghanistan, it will be a disaster, he says. If he begins an immediate 100% pullout, it will be a disaster, too. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. See ya.